Well, I don't know how big God is to you, but depending upon how big God is to you, it will change your world. Depending upon the difference of how big God is in your world is going to change your world completely. See, if God is fairly small, and what we're going to see this morning as we unpack this, if God is fairly small in your world, you basically you'll keep him tucked away, and he's more of a convenience to you. You'll keep him there, and you'll keep him available when you need to pull the God card out. Oh, man, things aren't going so well. God, we pray that you'll help me in this moment. God's fairly small in your world. If he's just available, if he's just a part of your life, he's fairly small. But, if God is who he is, and he is in the proper place in your world, and he's big, your world is completely transformed and changed. If God is who he is, in your world, and he is has the proper place in your world, everything changes. Your satisfaction changes. Your sight changes. Your purpose changes. What you do and the decisions that you make, all of those things change if God has the proper place, and he is really that big in your world. So let me try to help answer that. Think on this. How big is God in your world? If you were to picture our solar system, here it is up on the screen, you'll see like our solar system, right? All of the planets will revolve around the sun, right? The sun is the center of our solar system, and then those planets go all around that sun, right? The sun is huge. Here's the question. In your world, what does the sun represent? Is the sun you, or is it God? In other words, who revolves around who? If God is in the center, everything revolves around him, and your aim and your purpose and everything that motivates you, that drives you, is all around him. If it's flip-flopped and God just kind of revolves around your world, he's fairly small and he's just somewhat available, but it all becomes about you. It becomes about your happiness, the things that you do. In what place is God for you? You see, what happens with God's people in Numbers is they get this flip-flopped. And God becomes incredibly small in their world. And they get completely off track. Everything kind of falls apart. But if your sights are on following the Lord and God is the one who's center of your life and everything goes around that, you'll find your satisfaction completely different. We'll see that as we unpack here. God's people in our study through the book of Numbers here get things backwards. They rebel against God. They reject him. They head in the complete opposite direction from where he is directing them and where he's placing them. And the costs, as we're going to see, are astounding. The people of God's people are on the edge of the promised land is where we come to in chapter 13. They're ready to finally enter into the blessings that God has for them. They've been taken out of slavery, out of Egypt, of which they've been in slavery for 400 years. And now, finally, Moses, God's leader, has led them out of slavery, and they are on the brink of getting into the promised land, the land of Israel that God has promised them hundreds of years earlier. And God is going to deliver on his promise. They're right on the brink of that. It's this, in this place, that as they go and move into the promised land, that they're going to be a light to the other nations that are around them, to be a, to show that God is in the center of their world. That's the intent. That's God's intent. But instead of this being the point of celebration for them, it becomes a point of absolute rebellion, of unbelief, and the results are tragic. What we see this morning is really here in Numbers 13 and 14 is the central story of all the book of Numbers. This is, if you've ever heard anything about Numbers, this is probably the story that you hear. It's the most serious case of rebellion. We're going to see more of it. But this is the most serious case, both in terms of the offense against God as well as the punishment that comes, that it draws. And as we're going to see, because of their rebellion, because of God's people's rebellion against God, God's people are going to stay in the wilderness for another 40 years before taking the promised land. What we find here in Numbers chapter 13 is Israel's darkest hour. It's right here. If you haven't turned there already, Numbers chapter 13 is what we're going to unpack. Numbers 13, I want to look at just the first three verses, get us started here about the good stuff that's happening. Numbers chapter 13, verse 1 says this. Follow along with me. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan. That's the land of Israel, which I am giving to the people of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers, you shall send a man, every one a chief among them. So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord. All of them men who were heads of the people of Israel. So Moses, the leader, tells them to, out of the 12 tribes, there's 12 tribes that make up the nation of Israel, God's people, pick one man out of each tribe, and they're going to be made up of this team that's going to go and scout out the land of Israel. There's a map here, if you can kind of make it out there, you can see Israel there in the green, and they're going to be moving from the south down in a place called Kadesh, in the wilderness of Paran, which is in the south end, and they're going to be traveling all the way up to the very top, and they're going to come back down. It's going to spend 40 days doing that. Just as God has commanded, he said, hey, go send out the spies and go check out the land. And well, what is it they're supposed to do specifically? Well, here's what it says. Look at verses 17. By the way, if you look at verses 4 through 16, it's a list of the men that are chosen for that. Verse 17, here's what Moses says. God says, Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, go up into the Negev and go up into the hill country and see what the land is and whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, and whether the land that they dwell in is good or bad, and whether the cities that they dwell in are camps or strongholds, and whether the land is rich or poor, and whether there are trees in it or not. Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land. Now, the time of the season of the first ripe grapes. Jump over to verse 25. At the end of 40 days, they return from spying out the land. So they're going to bring back this report. The spies head out of the land. They move up into that area, and they do a whole canvassing of it. In fact, they grab some all kinds of grapes. Grapes so large that it takes two men on a pole to carry them. I mean, that's fruitful land. They bring pomegranates and figs and all kinds of stuff back. The aim of their mission, keep this in mind, the aim of their spying out the land is to decide, it wasn't to decide this, it's not to decide whether it's permissible or possible or desirable for them to go and do that. The mission should be an encouragement for them. It's an encouragement to see that God is faithful. He's going to accomplish what he has promised his people. It should encourage him. It should give them fortitude about what they're about ready to do. Look at verse 2 again, real quick. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, God said, send men to spy out the land of Canaan. If you want to underline this, you can underline this. Which I am giving to the people of Israel. He is giving them this land. Don't forget that. God's going to give them the land. Don't forget. It's super important as we unpack the rest of this. He's promised to give them this. So as we consider how big their God is, that's going to be really important. Well, the first reports start coming in. The spies go up 40 days. They check out the land. They come back down 40 days. They gather everybody together. Here's the report. Look at verses 26 and 27. And they came to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the people of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. So they gathered everybody together and they brought back word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told them, we came to the land to which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. This is, I don't know if you get excited about this as like Angela and I do, when you go to Costco right now, if you walk over in the fruit section, you walk over by anywhere about 10 feet around the peaches, and you start smelling those peaches. It's like, we eat so many peaches right now. We have to like kind of limit ourselves. The fruit is so great right now. It's summertime. We love this time. We have oatmeal in the mornings with all kinds of fruit. The oatmeal is just simply there as a mechanism for all the fruit that we eat. And we love it. This is a great time. This is what's going on. It's a great season. It is ripe. It is fresh. So many great things. This is the land. You're going to see this phrase over and over again. The land flowing of milk and honey. That means it's good. This is really good land. In many respects, this report is so positive. This missions trip was a complete success in so many ways. They explored the whole land. They spent time, if you were to read there, you spent some time around Hebron. What does that mean? Well, if you know that this is where Abraham and many of the patriarchs were buried in this area. They were over the same ground that God promised them. This is specifically a trip to remind them that God has promised this land to them. God has given them directions. I've promised you this. He's going to deliver. That's what this trip is all about. And so far, everything is going great. In fact, they're 40 days. They've traversed the land safely. They've scouted it out. There's been no opposition. And man, the land is amazing, but the place is amazing, but verse 28 and 29, it goes south. But, however, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites dwell in the hill country, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the Jordan. There is no way we're going to ever be able to get in there. The land, here's what they're saying. The land is absolutely infested with ites. It's terrible. We're not going to be able to take this. Everything at this point turns on this report. This right here is the moment. Verses 28 and 29. This is the moment when they become the center of their worlds. This is the moment when God in their world becomes small. So small, in fact, that from this moment on, they don't even bring God into the equation. They don't even bring God up. At least wise, not until a little bit later when they start to accuse God of evil. But we'll save that for a moment. But there is one here who keeps God in the center. I don't know what it does for you, but can you imagine everyone around you is going in the opposite direction from God, and then you speak up to the exact opposite from everyone else? That's one who has God in the center, and that's what's going on here in the next verse, verse 30. Take a look. But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." Boom, I love this guy. This guy has guts. This is what it looks like to have guts, faith in God. Why can't he do this? Because God is big. His faith is completely, this is bold faith right here in verse 30. This is incredibly rare, by the way. I love this guy. I love the conviction. Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. Let's do it. I love that. Years later, God is going to be doing a search, and in Ezekiel, he says, "And I sought for a man among them who should build up the wall and stand in the gap before me for the land, that I should not destroy it." And in this tragic account that God says, "But I found none." Do you know what? He found one here in verse 30, in this moment. Caleb speaks up against the crowd. He withstands this tidal wave of cultural change that's happening in this moment. He stands up to that because God is big. God is in the center of his vision, of his sights. He keeps God in the center. And when God is in the center, you can do just what God calls you to do. When God is in the center, you will have boldness and confidence and his power to accomplish what he's called you to do. In 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 9, it says, "For the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth, that he may strongly support those whose hearts are completely his." You will have his strength. Now, just because God calls you, just because you have bold faith and to stand against the trends, it doesn't mean everything's going to go well. It doesn't mean that everything's going to be easy for you now. See, I have God's strength. We're going to do really well. Things don't necessarily get easy. Look at how the rest of the crowd responds in verses 31 through 33. Then the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are." So they brought to the people of Israel a bad or an evil report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." We seem like grasshoppers. It means they're going to eat us for lunch. The people we saw, they're huge. They're giants in the land. The 10 spies, there's 12 of them. Two are going to stand out, Caleb and Joshua. We'll see him in a moment. 10 of the spies are stirring up the people with enormous fear. And they start throwing in false reports about the kinds of people that are in the land. I'm wondering if when you start getting fearful, the thing you're scared about becomes even bigger. Man, by the moment, the people there in the, that are dwelling in the land are getting bigger by the minute. They're going to eat us for lunch, and that's the report. It's amazing to me that out of 12 people that go, they spy out the land, they experience the same thing, that 10 of them see everything one way, and 2 of them see it a completely different way. But they had the same experience, saw the same things. Seeing is not believing. Seeing is not the same as believing, but believing is seeing. I had to wonder why, as I'm studying through here, why did these 10 spies, why did they come to this conclusion, this tragic conclusion? After all that God had told them about the land and that he was going to give them the land, why did they come to this conclusion? Ultimately, I think it's because they believe, it's because God was small. They aren't looking to the Lord. You'll never see that in here. They aren't looking to God. They aren't encouraging one another of all that God has already done. Hello, taking them out of slavery, parted the Red Sea, provided for them. They aren't encouraging about what he has promised to do. They aren't looking at that at all. And then I wondered if maybe they were thinking, maybe they started to think, this is going to be way too hard. This is going to be tough. The costs are going to be far too great. This is going to be painful to try to take the land. This isn't going to be easy, guys. And that wouldn't be so far from where we land, is it? We want easy. We want convenience. And if God isn't convenient, we won't be bothered. When that happens, when you choose the easiest road and not the road that God is choosing, God becomes small. And you swap places. You become the center. It becomes what you want, when you want it, how you want it. He becomes the outside revolving around, and we're happy to do it as long as it fits within our schedule. I wonder if that crossed their mind. The report from the 10 pushes the rest of the people to incredible depths of despair. Look at verse 1 of chapter 14. Then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night. It continues to spiral and unravel. Verse 2, and all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Now, don't miss this. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land? To fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? They begin to suspect that God has evil intents, evil intentions. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land so we can fall by the sword? God becomes small. So small, in fact, that you actually start to think that, God, you just brought us here to kill us. and their fear distorts their vision. So distorted is their vision that verse 4, that they said to one another, let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt. Are you serious? They're ready to go back to slavery? Like, have you forgotten where you just came from? You want to go back? And then it just strikes me. You know how many times I go through the Old Testament, I'm like, why would they do that? And then it just, that's me. I have a tendency to do the same thing. Don't we do the same thing? We give up and we give in so easily. As soon as there's a sign of like trouble or difficulty, we tap out. I'm done. Why did we give up so easy? So when we find ourselves in the wilderness, there's trials going on, we sometimes will have a tendency to harden our hearts to God because of the difficulties, and we want to turn back instead of pressing on to what God has for us. And we start, it's just going to be too hard. It's too difficult. God must not be in it because it's difficult. Need some examples? Here's the things I was thinking of. When we give up and we want to go back into slavery where we came from, we want to quickly just go back. If you're single and you're waiting for a spouse, you feel like, man, I want to be married. But instead of waiting on God, like God was maybe going to shortchange you, you cut corners. You go, obviously God's not showing up here, so let me help him out. And we cut the corners. Parents who won't discipline your kids anymore because it's just too difficult. You became a parent, guess what? It's going to be difficult. Your kids have a mind of their own sinful nature. If you're not sure about that, you're not a parent. They have a mind of their own, sinful nature. They're headed in that direction. They're hardwired. And you, as a parent, are to discipline them in the ways of the Lord. Been reading through our Bible reading with us? We're in Proverbs, all about there, about raise your children in the ways of the Lord. Point them towards, in a Godward direction. But we give up on that. It gets too difficult. How about waiting for sex? Instead of waiting for what God has for me, which he said is to take place in the relationship between a husband and a wife, and this is where sex is to be taking place because this is what I created it for. And it is best here. Instead, we get tired of waiting on God because maybe he's just going to shortchange me and he's not very faithful. So I'm not going to wait on him. We're just going to live together. We're going to test this out. We're going to just go with our emotions and our feelings. I mean, God gave us those feelings, right? So it can't be that bad. And we justify. When God says, I have something better for you. When God is small, he revolves around us. We switch places. How about waiting for the finances? Instead of waiting for God to provide for how he is leading, which he is never short on. And I realize it comes up not just to the 11th hour. I've heard that long enough to know that it's 11:59 and 59 seconds, 0.999. But we jump ahead of God. And we take on all kinds of debt, from credit card debt to school debt. How many of us are buried in school debt right now? When we just ran ahead, we said, well, that's what everybody does. That's what the culture does. They promise that we can get this paid off, no problem. Good, you have $100,000 in debt, you're going to get a $40,000 job. Good luck on paying that off. That wasn't God. We run ahead. When fear comes up, you know what we do? We create out of our own imaginations the worst case scenario, don't we? This is what's going to happen. It's just going to be terrible. We just start creating these things out of our own. We do the same thing. But the promises of God are so much greater. The promises of God are that much better. Oh, if we'd only run to him instead of just trying to figure it out on our own. One writer put it this way, Lord, I crawled across the barrenness to you with my empty cup, uncertain in asking any small drop of refreshment. If only I had known you better, I'd have come running with a bucket. God's faithful. Here, God's people in this moment, their hearts have rejected God's plan, and ultimately they reject God. Verses 5 through 10, final verses here. Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the people of Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes and said to all the congregation of the people of Israel, "The land which we passed through to spy it out is exceedingly good land. And if the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey." Verse 9, key verse. "Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." Then all the congregation said to stone them with stones, but the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the people of Israel. Look where the eyes are set for Joshua and Caleb. You see what they're looking at? Verse 9 again. "Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land." Next sentence. "Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." Twice. "Do not fear. Do not fear." Who's in the center of their vision? God. Why? Because God's big. God is who he says he is. God will deliver on his promises. Don't rebel against the Lord. Do not fear. The Lord is with us. Do not fear them. Their God is big. They saw the same giants as the majority of them did, protected by the same city walls, and yet concluded that the pagans of the nations there not only could be, but must be defeated. Completely different vision. Completely different sight. And again, though, just because you go and do all that God's called you to do, it doesn't always go well. But don't miss that verse 10. Then all the congregation said to stone them with stones. They're going to kill them. The congregation, all the people are rising up. We're going to kill them. You know what? You will never die a moment too soon or too late. Not one second will you go before your time is up. It's in God's hands. Look what God does. "But the glory of the Lord appeared." Oh, man. We'll pick up the story next week. God steps in. So let me close with these questions. Who's in the center of your world? What's in the center of your universe, your world? Is it you or is it God? Who revolves around who? This morning, do you need to swap? Do you need to put God in his rightful place? Here's your opportunity. You're no longer enslaved. You've been set free because God is faithful to accomplish what he has said. To whatever he has called you to do, you don't have to outwit him or outsmart him or go before him. Wait on the Lord if you need to wait. Trust him. Put your eyes on him. Put God in the rightful place, in the center, and set your eyes on him.